From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
President Trump is the first president in a generation to seek to end war rather than start one.
That was Senator Rand Paul at the Republican National Convention's Tuesday evening session.
Compare President Trump with the disastrous record of Joe Biden, who's consistently called for more war. Joe Biden voted for the Iraq War, which President Trump has long called the worst geopolitical mistake of our generation. I fear Biden will choose war again.
More than 17 years have passed since the U.S. invaded Iraq in March of 2003, and that was a dozen years after the first U.S. invasion in early 1991. The arrival of U.S. troops into Iraq was supposed to bring about a new day for the Iraqi people. On Wednesday, we had a sample of how they're doing in this discussion about the COVID-19 virus on the ground in that country. This was the Special Representative of the UN Secretary General for Iraq and head of the UN Assistance Mission for Iraq, Jeanine Hennis-Plasschaert, briefing an open teleconference of the UN Security Council this past Wednesday.
No country or community has been spared the devastating impact of COVID-19, and Iraq is no exception. To the contrary, the pandemic has aggravated deep existing economic and social challenges. A few salient numbers to illustrate humanitarian concerns. Poverty has increased by over 10% in recent months. One third of Iraqis now live below the poverty line, and two out of five suffer multiple deprivations in accessing basic social services and rights. Food consumption is now insufficient for over 3 million Iraqis due to reduced purchasing power rather than food scarcity. With regards to education, over 11 million school and university students across Iraq have seen their studies disrupted. And gender-based violence has alarmingly doubled amid dwindling options for victims to seek assistance and find shelter. Now, in terms of our response to these challenges, I reiterate my earlier message with regards to humanitarian access on the ground. We need a simplified system that enables currently immobilized humanitarian actors and supplies to rapidly reach people in need. Positive discussions are underway with the government, and we now hope to receive a decision within days. In terms of security, conditions for humanitarian actors are also hazardous in certain areas, as was starkly highlighted today by the IED explosion that impacted a World Food Program convoy in Nineveh. Mr. President, economic trouble is never far from humanitarian concerns. Iraq is expected to experience a 9.7% decline in GDP. Oil revenues, severely affected by a steep crash in oil prices, have nearly halved. The private sector has been particularly impacted by job losses and income reduction. It also remains hindered by a lack of reforms. Non-oil GDP growth is decelerating in a country that is in dire need of economic diversification. And lest we forget, corruption remains endemic and its economic cost untold as it continues to steal desperately needed resources from the everyday Iraqi, eroding investor confidence. Crucially, this scourge of corruption also drives many of Iraq's security issues. Now, the Iraqi government recognizes these challenges and has made economic and financial reform a priority. The Minister of Finance is expected to deliver a detailed economic reform plan to Parliament imminently. But for important, painful reforms to take root within an historical context of perceived rights and entitlements, the political class must come together as one, prioritizing the country's interest and protecting the vulnerable. So far, however, we have seen too little of this spirit. But let me emphasize, these reforms are of great importance to unlock a brighter future for all Iraqis, one in which the country can move from putting out fires to building sustainable solutions and domestic resilience. As I have said before many times, an environment that promotes inclusive growth and employment remains the best remedy against unrest, conflict, and external interference. Now, Mr. President, the government of Iraq is undoubtedly operating in the eyes of multiple storms at once. Unresolved, long-standing grievances have not disappeared, and Iraqis want their voices to be heard. In recent months, social unrest has continued throughout Iraq, albeit somewhat muted by the ongoing pandemic. Of great concern is another spike in the killings and targeting of activists and human rights defenders. Now, the silencing of peaceful voices by exerting pressure on activists and media, by confusing the scene, or worse, by shedding blood, this deliberate silencing of peaceful voices is an affront against basic rights and dignity. And let us also remember those activists still missing, the ones in need of medical care, and those who had to flee the country, often living in difficult circumstances and unable to return to Iraq because of grave threats and intimidation. And yet, Mr. President, we do find reason to be cautiously encouraged by the statements and some early actions of the current government. Indeed, we are witnessing a move towards greater accountability, more robust support to freedom of expression and assembly, and also tangible commitment to justice. These are certainly hopeful signs, but further action is urgently needed to deliver true justice and accountability. Condemning the violence and announcing investigations are only a first step. Now, those who know and love Iraq recognize how puzzling the Iraqi context is, with too many parties pursuing their own narrow interests, weakening the state from within. Oblivious partisanship and short-sighted zero-sum politics continue to be major obstacles for progress. But to be clear, no party, person, or entity must be allowed to hijack the legitimate demands of the Iraqi people. Mr. President, to my great regret, armed groups continue to recklessly flex their muscles, generally seeking to create an environment of blunt intimidation. This means that while Iraqi citizens are in desperate need of a stable, safe, and secure environment, the saber-rattling continues. Surely we all agree that Iraqis can scarcely afford another cycle of escalating violence. It is high time for these militant actors to take a long, hard look in the mirror. And benefiting from internal divisions, exploiting security gaps, Daesh continues to claim lives. Now, Mr. President, the government of Iraq also operates in a uniquely challenging geopolitical environment. And I would like to salute and encourage Iraqi efforts to emphasize national independence and sovereignty. The Iraqi government is determined to keep multiple channels of communication and exchange open, opting for state-to-state dialogue and relationship building first and foremost. I sincerely hope that Iraq will be given further room to focus on its domestic resilience instead of being used as a venue for different power competitions. The recent escalation in Iraqi-Turkish border areas is also a matter of great concern. We continue to urge both countries to resolve their differences through dialogue and cooperation with full respect for national sovereignty. Mr. President, a central popular demand has consistently been the holding of early elections, and the date of 6 June 2021 has now been announced. However, Parliament has not yet resolved the crucial questions of seat apportionment and constituency delineation. Now, technical considerations, not partisanship, must govern their finalization. Equally important, IHEC, the Independent High Electoral Commission, must be strengthened and freed from persistent political pressures, particularly in personnel selection, as well as the development and implementation of electoral procedures. To address electoral challenges and build public confidence in its impartiality and technical capabilities, IHEC also needs to adopt workable measures such as a comprehensive, inclusive voter registry, a transparent, tested and reliable election resource system, and a judicious framework to handle electoral complaints and appeals. And of course, UNAMI stands ready to assist. Now, restoring public trust is hard work. And within that context, free and fair elections will prove crucial. An electoral reset could open a new and important chapter for Iraq. But for this to happen, the elections must be credible. This is not only the responsibility of IHEC and the government, but also of all Iraqi political actors and electoral stakeholders. Turning to Baghdad-Erbil relations, constructive negotiations are the only viable way forward. I have said it many times. Now, the Iraqi constitution was drafted under great time pressure in 2005. General principles were enshrined in the text, with their implementation left to be specified by subsequent supporting legislation. But 15 years later, this lack of specificity continues to shape the debate between the federal government and the KRG. 15 years without an agreement on the gradual enhancement of the federal system. 15 years without a deal on natural resource distribution or disputed territories. 15 years without laws enacted to clearly define the rights and obligations of both Baghdad and Erbil. Instead, we are witnessing another instance of ad hoc crisis management. I'm certain we can all agree that it is past time for Iraq to become more than the sum of its components. And yes, of course, we do cautiously salute the agreement, albeit tenuous, recently reached by Baghdad and Erbil on issues including the payment of Kurdish public salaries. Mr. President, earlier this month, we commemorated the 6th anniversary of the horrific Sinjar massacre. I regret to report yet again that preliminary agreement on a unified administration and stable security structures has failed to materialize. A final agreement can and must now be reached without delay. Anything else is intolerable negligence. Something else, in my most recent briefing in May, I emphasized that in the Kurdistan region, as elsewhere in Iraq, transparency, fighting corruption, freedom of expression, and fundamental reforms are of critical importance. I must repeat that message today. Forceful responses to public criticism, protests, harassments, or the shutting down of media outlets are surely not the way forward. Now, in confronting complex challenges, governments must also and always continue to defend fundamental rights and freedoms. Now, if you allow me, Mr. President, a few words on the rate of return for the remaining 1.4 million Iraqi IDPs, now at a three-year low. Understandably, it is the desire of every Iraqi to live in a country without displacement camps. But these camps will not disappear until durable solutions are found. We have initiated positive discussions with the government, but I would like to re-emphasize that the wishes of the IDPs for return or integration must be prioritized. And this in turn requires the cooperation of receiving and/or host communities. Mr. President, I would like to turn to the issue of missing Kuwaiti third country nationals and missing Kuwaiti property, including the National Archives. UNAMI is engaging with the International Committee of the Red Cross and the Iraqi and Kuwaiti authorities to repatriate Kuwaiti remains exhumed from a mass grave site in southern Iraq last January. Despite severe travel restrictions imposed by the pandemic, I am optimistic that the transfer will take place in the near future. Meanwhile, Kuwaiti forensics continue their complex DNA analysis to identify those Kuwaiti remains already repatriated last year. And we look forward to the announcement of their results in due course. Mr. President, in closing, I would like to pay tribute to the courage, discipline and sacrifice of Iraqi women and men in confronting shared hardship. It is essential that we maintain our support to the brave Iraqis who are not giving up, who continue to push for change. I will end by emphasizing that time is a critical factor. So yes, it is high time for tangible results. Thank you so much.
That was a report by the Special Representative of the UN Secretary General for Iraq, Jeanine Hennis Plaschaert, who gave a briefing at the opening of the UN Security Council teleconference on the situation concerning Iraq this past Wednesday. On February 2nd, 1960, four students from All-Black North Carolina Agriculture and Technical College walked into a Woolworth's Five and Dime for the second day in a row with the intention of ordering lunch at the lunch counter. But the manager of the Greensboro outlet had intentions of his own to maintain the lunch counter's strict whites-only policy. Among the four students was Clarence Henderson, and he was a speaker at Wednesday night's Republican National Convention.
I am Clarence Henderson. There have been movements that have changed the course of history. Among the most extraordinary was the Civil Rights Movement. 60 years ago, segregation was legal and enforced. The simple act of sitting at a lunch counter could lead to physical harm, jail time, or worse. I know from personal experience. Walking into Woolworth's department store on February 2nd, 1960, I knew it was unlike any day I'd experienced before. My friends had been denied service the day before because of the color of their skin. We knew it wasn't right. But when we went back the next day, I didn't know whether I was going to come out in a vertical or prone position, in handcuffs or on a stretcher, or even in a body bag. By sitting down to order a cup of coffee, we challenged injustice. We knew it was necessary, but we didn't know what would happen. We faced down the KKK. We were cursed at and called all kinds of names. They threatened to kill us, and some of us were arrested, but it was worth it. Our actions inspired similar protests throughout the South against racial injustice. And in the end, segregation was abolished, and our country moved a step closer to true equality for all. That's what actual peaceful protest can accomplish. America isn't perfect. We're always improving. But the great thing about this country is that it's not where you come from, it's where you're going. I was born on what some would call the wrong side of the tracks. I don't even have a birth certificate. I never attended an integrated school and am the only one out of my immediate family who graduated from college, an HBCU. I'm a military veteran and a civil rights activist. And you know what else? I'm a Republican and I support Donald Trump. If that sounds strange, you don't know your history. It was the Republican Party that passed the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. It was a Republican Party that passed the 14th Amendment, giving black men citizenship. It was the Republican Party that passed the 15th Amendment, giving black men the right to vote. Freedom of thought is a powerful thing. There are Americans, voters all over the country, who media is trying to convince to conform to the same old Democratic talking points. You know what that'll get you? The same old results. Joe Biden had the audacity to say, if you don't vote for him, you ain't black. Well, to that, I say, if you do vote for Biden, you don't know history. Donald Trump is not a politician. He's a leader. Politicians are a dime a dozen. Leaders are priceless. The record funding Trump gave HBCUs is priceless, too. So are the record number of jobs he created for the black community. and the investment he drove into our neighborhoods with tax incentives and opportunity zones. And so are the lives he restored by passing criminal justice reform, where 91% of the inmates released are black. These achievements demonstrate that Donald Trump truly cares about black lives. His policies show his heart. He has done more for black Americans in 4 years than Joe Biden has done in 50. Donald Trump is offering real and lasting change, an unprecedented opportunity to rise, a country that embraces the spirit of the civil rights movement of the 60s, a place where people are judged by the content of their character, their talents and abilities, not by the color of their skin. This is the America I was fighting for 60 years ago. This is the America Donald Trump is fighting for today. Thank you.
That was Clarence Henderson, one of four students who sat in at a Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, on February 2nd, 1960, the second day of the Greensboro sit-in. The keynote speaker at Wednesday's session of the RNC was Vice President Michael Pence.
Good evening, America. It's an honor to speak to you tonight from the hallowed grounds of Fort McHenry, the site of the very battle that inspired the words of our national anthem. Those words have inspired this land of heroes in every generation since. It was on this site 206 years ago when our young republic heroically withstood a ferocious naval bombardment from the most powerful empire on earth. They came to crush our revolution, to divide our nation, and to end the American experiment. The heroes who held this fort took their stand for life, liberty, freedom, and the American flag. And those ideals have defined our nation. But they were hardly ever mentioned at last week's Democratic National Convention. Instead, Democrats spent 4 days attacking America. Joe Biden said that we were living through a season of darkness. But as President Trump said, where Joe Biden sees American darkness, we see American greatness. In these challenging times, our country needs a president who believes in America, who believes in the boundless capacity of the American people to meet any challenge, defeat any foe, and defend the freedoms we hold dear. America needs 4 more years of President Donald Trump in the White House. Four years ago, I answered the call to join this ticket because I knew that Donald Trump had the leadership and the vision to make America great again. And for the last 4 years, I've watched this president endure unrelenting attacks, but get up every day and fight to keep the promises that he made to the American people. So with gratitude for the confidence President Donald Trump has placed in me, the support of our Republican Party, and the grace of God, I humbly accept your nomination to run and serve as Vice President of the United States. Serving the American people in this office has been a journey I never expected. It's a journey that would not have been possible without the support of my family, beginning with my wonderful wife, Karen. She's a lifelong school teacher, an incredible mother to our three children. And she is one outstanding Second Lady of the United States. I'm so proud of you. And we couldn't be more proud of our three children. Marine Corps Captain Michael J. Pence and his wife, Sarah. Our daughter, Charlotte Pence Bond, an author and the wife to Lieutenant Henry Bond, who is currently deployed and serving our nation in the United States Navy. And our youngest, a recent law school grad, our daughter Audrey and her fiancé, who, like so many other Americans, had to delay their wedding this summer. But we can't wait for Dan to be a part of our family. In addition to my wife and kids, the person who shaped my life the most is also with us tonight. My mom, Nancy. She is the daughter of an Irish immigrant, 87 years young. And mom follows politics very closely. And the truth be told, sometimes I think I'm actually her second favorite candidate on the Trump-Pence ticket. Thank you, Mom. I love you. Over the past 4 years, I've had the privilege to work closely with our president. I've seen him when the cameras are off. Americans see President Trump in lots of different ways. But there's no doubt how President Trump sees America. He sees America for what it is. A nation that has done more good in this world than any other. A nation that deserves far more gratitude than grievance. And if you want a president who falls silent when our heritage is demeaned or insulted, he's not your man. Now, we came by very different routes to this partnership. And some people think we're a little bit different. But you know, I've learned a few things watching him. Watching him deal with all that we've been through over the past 4 years. He does things in his own way, on his own terms. Not much gets past him. And when he has an opinion, he's liable to share it. He's certainly kept things interesting. But more importantly, President Donald Trump has kept his word to the American people. In a city known for talkers, President Trump is a doer. And few presidents have brought more independence, energy, or determination to that office. 4 years ago, we inherited a military hollowed out by devastating budget cuts, an economy struggling to break out of the slowest recovery since the Great Depression. ISIS controlled a landmass twice the size of Pennsylvania, and we witnessed a steady assault on our most cherished values, freedom of religion, and the right to life. That's when President Donald Trump stepped in. And from day one, he kept his word. And with that renewed energy, we also returned American astronauts to space on an American rocket for the first time in nearly 10 years. And after years of scandal that robbed our veterans of the care that you earned in the uniform of the United States, President Trump kept his word again. We reformed the VA. And Veterans Choice is now available for every veteran in America.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.